What's up, brother? What's up?
This is a new recording, man.
Yeah, brother, like, solid. Right on.
There's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, Father, we don't need to.
Good morning and welcome back to What's Going On with Earl Ingram. I am excited, as always, to have an opportunity to come before you, the listening audience, but I'm doubly excited, triply excited. Is that such a word as triply?
Triply. Well,
I guess I just created it, right? because a really good friend and a very brilliant man has chosen to be my guest once again, none other than Mr. Sandy Williams. Good to see you, Sandy. How's the new year?
Well, I'm doing all right. 2026. I've been practicing writing it for the last couple of days.
Yeah, I don't think I've had to write it down yet, but I soon will. You know,
it's unimaginably far into the future as far as I'm concerned, but there we are.
Well, I think it was Pete Hegseth who on Saturday said, "Welcome to 2026.
America.
Yeah, America, welcome to 2026. But Sandy, man, we got a lot to talk about this morning, and I couldn't, after what transpired on Friday night, and I got up Saturday morning and thought I was in the twilight zone. You know, it's still trying to, you know, get my faculties together, and I turned the television on and thought I was hearing things, and soon I was riveted to the television set before I could even go and get a cup of coffee or do anything else. I'm riveted because I couldn't believe what my lying eyes were showing me or what I was hearing. But we invaded a sovereign nation, took the president and his wife away. 156 aircraft, Sandy, were used. We had that big flotilla over there. We knew something was going to happen. 156 aircraft, Sandy, to capture the president and the wife of Venezuela. Man, tell me I'm not living in a nightmare. Tell me this is not a nightmare.
This is the most extreme example we've now been given of what the vision for the U.S. foreign policy is now. This notion of the corollary to the Monroe Doctrine, which has been talked about, which basically is when you read the discussion in the paper that was issued on the new foreign policy of the United States, it's seemingly a reinstatement of what Henry Kissinger called realpolitik, which is the recognition of real power possessed by countries, the hegemony that countries have in a geographic region, and the respect for it. And what this amounts to when you read the U.S. policy was that the United States is going to focus its interests on the Western Hemisphere. It's going to let Europe solve its problems for itself, and including with Russia, and that the South China Sea and the China hegemony will also, in some respects, be honored. So that this action is a reflection, I think, of that policy, which is a sort of a division of the world into the three hegemonic hemispheres of interest of three major powers. In this case, I think it's the recognition, at least by the current administration, of the power of Russia in its hegemony, and probably Eastern Europe, the power of China in the South China Sea, and the power of the United States in the Western Hemisphere. And that power seems to include the power to affect and control the policies of the countries within that field, so that the Soviet invasion of Ukraine begins to look a great deal like the implementation of the same policy.
Sandy, you used the verbiage control. Was that a slip of the tongue?
No, not really. I mean, you know, we've talked about imperialism, and imperialism has long been taught in schools and others as sort of a horror. It's the thing that's done by countries when they wield their might in a manner which is contrary to the interests of the rest of the world. But the definition of imperialism is when a state intends its power to extends its power beyond its own borders to dominate territories or peoples for their own benefit. And I guess one of the issues with respect to the current administration is that the president is an extremely transparent person, i.e., he seems to verbalize, he says the silent part, the part that is normally left silent, gets verbalized. So in this case, Donald Trump immediately after this invasion said that we were going to run Venezuela, we were going to run it for the interests of the United States, and in fact, the Secretary of State reiterated that same position even when talked to the next day, which was that we're going to make sure that the policies that are implemented by the country of Venezuela are in the first instance in the interest of the United States, because it is a matter of our strategic interest that we have access to the natural resources of and otherwise be in a position to have substantial influence over the operations of a country like Venezuela, which is putting words to what is otherwise the silent part. The nuance of power has been to exercise it without doing it and exclaiming it to be the exercise of imperialism. But we have apparently decided to take the mask off.
So, Sandy, I couldn't wait to have this conversation with you because all sorts of things were running through my head and through my mind, because all I could think about is we talk about other nations doing things like this and we talk about them in a negative manner. I've never visualized or thought of our nation being the one to do such a thing.
Well, I mean, you know,
we've
done it in the past, and we've usually denied culpability so that, you know, the Pinochet gets installed over Salvador Allende in Chile, and when we sort of take modest steps to deny any involvement in the military putsch that accomplished that, but it was clear that we were involved. And we've had other, you know, the Bay of Pigs was an aborted, unsuccessful effort to in the same sort of manner. But, you know, I'm not sure I disagree wholeheartedly with the notion of recognizing hegemonic power, but the question is, how is it exercised? We could be exercising our power in the Western Hemisphere with a carrot. We could be hanging out opportunities to countries like Venezuela to do things that were in their interest and also in our interest by offering them opportunities of value to them and by providing foreign assistance, etc. But that takes patience, because it's a campaign that takes a while. And apparently this current behavior suggests a lack of patience with respect to carrying out that sort of endeavor. The Chinese involvement in Africa has been much more like the former, hanging carrots out in front of the countries in terms of the construction of infrastructure, etc. And we would complain that it looks like economic imperialism because of the nature of the debt that's being incurred by those countries and the influence that's being achieved. But it's not being achieved by guns. It's being achieved by butter. And so I think what is unclear about this current policy is the extent to which the United States intends to continue to use gunboat diplomacy rather than economic diplomacy, particularly in the Western Hemisphere. The current administration has rattled the sword toward Colombia in the last 24 hours, reiterated its interest in Greenland,
Cuba,
and it's suggested that the current vice president, who's become the head of Venezuela, could have a fate worse than Maduro's were she not to be cooperating with the United States to implement policies that are in our interest.
So Sandy, maybe this was on the docket all along, and maybe it's been growing, and I haven't noticed it, but the fact that we've chosen to move away from our commitments and relationships with Europe and the East, and now move toward in this direction, is that something that we've been kind of working towards as a nation, or is this all of a sudden a completely different diametric change in our foreign policy?
It's certainly a change in direction. I mean, the prior administration was talking about pivoting towards Asia and focusing on what they viewed as the threats posed by China. But the doctrine that was announced in this new policy paper by the current administration goes a lot further than that and is much different than that, actually, because it talks about this hegemonic view of the world with the Chinese area of influence, the European area of influence, and the Western Hemisphere, which is essentially our area of influence. And it begins to make look a little bit more cohesive, this talk about Canada as a 51st state. There's some talk about focusing more interest in direct interest that we're currently focusing on Venezuela, on Mexico. So, you know, there is a concern I have, numbers of concerns. I mean, the world order has been premised on something different than what has been the basis for the action over the weekend. There was a Prussian philosopher named von Clausewitz who wrote about foreign policy. And in 1832, he wrote a book called War. And in there, he says, war is a continuation of foreign policy, just in a different manner, which is kind of a cynical pronouncement that war is really just a projection of foreign policy. And if economic policy isn't working, you can resort to guns and power. And, you know, the rule up until World War II was basically the rule of power and unbridled power, which had been in place basically since the Gilded Age in America. The gunboat diplomacy of Teddy Roosevelt and those in the latter part of the 19th century was premised on the United States flexing its muscle. The Monroe Doctrine, when it was issued, was really just to say, look, we don't want other colonies in the United States. We don't want the Europeans extending colonies into the Western Hemisphere anymore. But in the latter half of the 19th century, it began to be interpreted as something that allowed the United States to exercise its direct influence over countries in South America and Latin America through this gunboat diplomacy. And gunboat diplomacy was always used kind of in the bully manner. We didn't pick any fights with anybody big enough on the playground to bloody our nose. We picked fights with people who would basically cower in the face of battleships offshore. And so that's been the nature of our interventions in South America. And I would say that the current administration is kind of a continuation of that view of foreign policy. We tend to flex our muscle with those who are far weaker, and we tend to avoid flexing our muscle with those who can counter our muscle in kind with, for instance, nuclear power.
So, Sandy, let me... You talked about the hegemony, and when we talk about now focusing on a different part of the world, we built a military force, Sandy, that was built to address the eastern half of the world and to protect all of, you know, Europe and those places. And now we're going to abdicate that, Sandy, and move. What about all the money and all the military build that we built in order to address the Eastern Bloc? And what happens now with that focus?
Well, that was NATO. And, you know, the concept of the world after World War I was that Europe was the place where terrible things happened and that the United States had an interest in achieving peace there. And after World War II, we did set up a rules-based international order. The UN, the UN has an Article 2.4, which basically says countries will resist the use of force against one another and will respect the sovereignty of others. There has been, since the 17th and 18th centuries, the Westphalian era, it was called, the notion that the sovereignty of other countries and various countries are equal, regardless of their independent power, and that the sovereign immunity of the heads of state would be honored by countries. Now, you know, we obviously didn't stick with that in the context of the arrest of Noriega in 1989, and we obviously didn't stick with that with the arrest of Maduro. We also had the arrest of the Honduran president, that was after after he was no longer president. He was recently pardoned, interestingly enough. But so, you know, we've had this long kind of rule of order, which has been based on norms, not treaties. None of these things I've described are actual treaties. The United Nations is a bit of an international power without any teeth or fangs. And so this article that would cause us to respect the sovereignty of others is something that's been honored in the breach by the United States now, and by Russia with respect to Ukraine, and with the United States with respect to Iraq. But we should remember that in the invasion of Iraq, the United States went to great lengths, George Bush did, to enlist the support of many countries around the world. So whereas I'm not sure he achieved a resolution of the United Nations, he came very close to it by getting, I think he enlisted the support of over 85 countries before he went ahead and invaded Iraq to arrest its sovereign leader. And nothing of that sort was done before this. This was much more like a blitzkrieg in the middle of the night.
So, Sandy, international law, which, as you stated, we haven't always, you know, followed. We've condemned other nations for not following international law. What does it say now that we've done this? Let's say China decides now to move on Taiwan. What position does that leave us in? I mean, how do we then condemn China?
Well, I think what we've announced to the world is that rules be damned.
Yes.
It's the power of the United States which will be exercised wherever it can be exercised and wherever it has the power to be exercised. It's a bit like there's this Greek philosopher Thucydides, and he said, the strong do whatever they can and the weak suffer whatever they must. And this is that kind of an announcement of policy, that we are strong. In fact, a good deal of the press conference over the weekend was a discussion of the extreme, almost the infallibility of the U.S. military and its capacity to do things that no other military in the world could do, which, you know, unfortunately sounds a bit like hubris, and it's a bit like, I think, an NFL team after the first game of the season announcing that there isn't a team in the whole league that can stand up to it, and it's basically going to be undefeated. And that doesn't happen very often, and I think that the United States, then the extent of its power, hasn't been tested by its actions to date, but I suspect that we have to be cautious about the extent to which we use it, because there's a Newtonian principles. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction, and in international affairs, it might not happen overnight, but countries don't like to be dominated. They don't like to be the victim of imperialism by force. They like to make decisions that are in their self-interest, and if they believe they're doing so, it's a sustainable long-term policy. If it isn't, it's only a policy that can be sustained by the exercise of might. And history has taught us that it's not really possible to exercise might indefinitely.
So Sandy, all of these mixed messages initially, now we see going after these small fishing trawlers and blowing them up, and all these different times that we did that, and then led people to believe that we were doing this because they were poisoning the American children with the drugs, and that's why we were there. And okay, this is the main reason, this is the main purpose of it. And so you hear that and you kind of question it, and we've gotten to the point where, okay, it was happening so regularly that you thought, okay, all right, so if this is the worst they're going to do. But to go from there, Sandy, to invading and taking over a nation and then saying, we're going to take the oil.
We're going to run the country.
Yeah, come on, Sandy. Come on, man.
Yeah, well, I think the world at large, and most Americans, anybody who's gone to see Monty Python movies knows the old term nudge, nudge, wink, wink. And I think that everyone understood that all this talk about the interest in Venezuela being because it was the seat of all the poisonous drugs that were coming into the country, including fentanyl, which I think there's no evidence that
no.
Venezuela is a hotbed of a source for fentanyl. I think everyone understood that that was nudge, nudge, wink, wink, and that was what was being said, but that the real purpose behind it was the intent on making sure that the policies of Venezuela didn't run contrary to the interests of the United States with respect to its natural resources, and that those natural resources would be reopened to the United States. Trump talked again about, the president talked again about the nationalization of those oil wells and the interests of the oil companies that took place under Chavez. And so, you know, a great deal of this is really just the quiet part being said out loud, which is that this is really all about the United States' interest in making sure that the policies of Venezuela are first and foremost beneficial to the United States, and in particular with respect to critical natural resources.
Sandy, you know, again, from the time that I heard this, just a whole lot of things started running through my mind. And then you turn around and you hear, as you stated, the president, he can't keep this, he can't hold water. He's going to let it out because he's not fearful of anybody. He thinks he has the unilateral right to do everything because he's the president. He's making statements. They're going to make sure that Cuba now doesn't get any oil. They're going to collapse. And then when you're listening, and Sandy, if I'm China, if I'm Russia, and I'm getting oil from Venezuela, and now you're telling me you're shutting it off because it's mine, it's yours, I'm not going to sit still. I mean, I got to do something. What can they do?
Well, I suspect that these oil companies that Trump expects to move into and start drilling for oil, and I think it's very easy to drill successfully for oil in Venezuela, it having the largest oil reserves in the world. So, I mean, these oil wells, when drilled, will give a return, probably a very handsome return to the companies that own them. And I suspect those companies will be perfectly happy to sell oil to China and to Russia as customers. You know, this
higher prices.
Oil won't get to the United States by pipeline from Venezuela. It'll have to travel by ship. And ships, once they embark, can go to China and Russia just about as easily as they can go to the United States. It just takes a couple of more days. And so, I think that this is really much more about a mercenary interest than it is about a critical national interest. I mean, I do think that China was making inroads in South America much the same way that it was making inroads in Africa, which is by offering things of value to these countries in South America to a degree, a much greater and more aggressive degree than the United States had been. So, you know, maybe the United States does need to pay much more attention to the countries in its own backyard, but I'm not sure that those countries will appreciate it if the attention being paid involves 156 aircraft in the middle of the Saturday night.
Sandy, so Donald Trump, the president said, we're going to run the country. He's repeated it. It wasn't a slip of the tongue. He's come back again and again and again and said, we're going to run the country. What does he mean by that?
Well, like I said, it's the quiet part out loud. I mean, you know, we definitely meddled in Ukraine and in the Maidan Revolution in 2014. We've definitely meddled in Chile. We've meddled in Honduras. We've meddled in Panama. We've meddled in Guatemala.
Libya.
Libya. We've done things through our CIA to try and make sure that governments are installed who are friendly to the United States. And frequently the calculus for which government it is that would be installed doesn't have to do with whether it's a democratic government. It has more to do with whether the government that's installed is friendly and a supplicant, basically, to the interests of the United States and the businesses of the United States that can profit from operations in that country. And so, you know, this is a long-term policy. You can't blame the current administration for having an imperialistic view of the power over South America and Latin America. We've been exercising it since gunboat diplomacy in the late 1800s. But this is a much more open and kind of flagrant exercise of it. And like I said, we're saying the quiet part out loud. The question is whether the American people needed to have the quiet part kept a secret, or whether the American people are willing to embrace a foreign policy which is, by self-declaration, an imperialistic one. And that interests me, because I'm not sure what the American people will think about that. America First could mean an imperialistic America which exercises its power to the extent that its military can coerce policies of other countries to be beneficial to the United States, or it couldn't be that the United States and the citizens of the United States are not comfortable with that kind of an approach.
So Sandy, I remember not so long ago Colin Powell telling President George Bush Jr. About Iraq, if you break it, you own it. Clearly, you know, Venezuela, since Hugo Chavez and his leadership and now leadership that followed, has not exactly been the best. But I will say this, you know, financially, I think the Venezuelan people were doing much better under Hugo Chavez economically than they certainly were in the end of this. But what are the inherent threats? Dangers, the inherent dangers.
Well, I mean, you know, we can all recall the joy that was experienced as we watched the statue of Saddam Hussein be pulled over by Iraqis. And we had a view that the Iraqi people were going to embrace the invaders as liberators, and that soon after the toppling of Saddam Hussein, there would be an election and democracy would be installed, and we would have a democratic government operating efficiently and effectively in Iraq, and we would change the Mideast. And of course, none of that materialized, because what happened was a vacuum of power.
Right.
We destroyed the military of Iraq. We outlawed the Ba'ath Party, which had been in power in Iraq for a long time. We left a vacuum, and what filled the vacuum was chaos and anarchy and ISIS, ultimately, something that was a horror. So Saddam Hussein was a bad guy. He might not have been as destructive of its economy as Maduro has been destructive of the Venezuelan economy. And I think Maduro took a country that he inherited from Chavez, which had a GDP of something like $340 billion. And I think today it's estimated its GDP is 125. So he destroyed the economy. He destroyed the welfare of many, many Venezuelan people. 8 million Venezuelans have fled Venezuela to try and find better life. So there's no question that Maduro has not been good for the Venezuelan people. The question is whether toppling him, decapitating the country as we have, and apparently we've decided to honor the power of the vice president, who was vice president under Maduro, who is undoubtedly a part of the same corrupt political apparatus. And so we've decided to honor her power with the understanding that she has agreed for us to exercise our leverage over her and that she will adopt policies that are beneficial to us, exercising, I guess, and flexing the muscle of that corrupt political apparatus that she might be in control of. But Venezuela is filled with political factions, things, you know, we haven't been fed much information about it because the United States media doesn't cover Venezuela very carefully. But my understanding is there are 40 or 50 different political factions, many of them leftist, not right wing or conservative business orientation. We don't know what would fill the vacuum. We didn't decide to honor this fellow Rodriguez, who was apparently the one who actually won the election in 2024 by over 30 percentage points, or Machada, the woman who won the Nobel Prize this last year, who was a part of the same political environment that Rodriguez was a part of. We haven't decided that they would be the recognized leaders, even though we recognize them as the winner of the election. The Biden administration recognized Rodriguez as the winner of that election. So, you know, we apparently are willing to embrace a pretty cynical view of how we're going to run Venezuela. Rubio tried to put the silent part back into the bottle by saying, well, we aren't going to run Venezuela directly. We're just going to exercise our leverage over their leader. But, you know, this is not going to be a process necessarily that can be predicted to be smooth, because it has never been smooth in the past. Upon decapitation of the leader of a country, most countries fall into something pretty close to anarchy, like Libya, like Somalia.
Hey, Sandy, a couple of things. There are bad guys all over the world, okay? And so that can't be the rationale. He's a bad guy. He's a bad guy. Yeah, we know he's a bad guy. There are bad guys all over the world. The other part of this is, Sandy, how much is this going to cost our nation, the American people? And at a time when health care is front and center, or was front and center, and now this is on the docket, in addition to other things, the issues that the American people are dealing with every day, Sandy, they get pushed back. And so they aren't going to be on the front burner. How do we keep them on the front burner?
Well, you know, when we've stepped into war, it's done, you know, historians can look back and say, you know, the United States national debt was under control. The Bretton Woods Agreement was in place. The dollar was, the gold was set at $35 an ounce. The world, the Bretton Woods Agreement and the dollar as reserve currency was working. And the only reason that we couldn't sustain it was the size of the deficits that the United States began to experience when it exercised its policies of what was called guns and butter, which meant you waged a big war that cost an enormous amount of money, but you didn't raise taxes to pay for it. You continued all of the domestic policies that made the people happy, and you just created huge deficits in the process. And those deficits resulted in the runaway inflation of the late 70s. We aren't currently exercising fiscal discipline, but we are undertaking things which could have great expense. We have a federal defense budget that now is $1 trillion, or at least that's what has been announced as the goal for it. And we claim to be exercising the power of the purse by bringing in revenues through tariffs, but the fact is that the deficit being experienced in 2025 was a huge federal deficit, and there isn't much promise that the federal deficit in this next year will be any less. It might be greater. So the problems that are caused by foreign adventurism without fiscal discipline are substantial.
Okay, Sandy, healthcare. We were just talking about this at the end of last year, you and I, several different podcasts we did on that. Right now, with this brewing and what is taking place, you know, this is another one of those things that pushes that off the front page.
No, absolutely. I mean, one of the reasons that something like healthcare has gotten to the point that it has, where it's consuming 20% of our GDP and is in a broken cycle, basically a death cycle based on increasing costs without increasing benefits to the American public, is that can has been kicked down the road for decades, and it's been kicked down the road simply by brush fires that are seemingly more important. Sometimes they aren't brush fires that even have a direct impact on the welfare of the American people. Sometimes it's things like scandals in the White House and efforts to impeach the sitting president, which consume all of the interests of Congress, but which deflects them from pursuing the work for the people.
Let me ask you, Sandy. I heard the president say, I spoke to the CEOs, the oil barons. I spoke to all of them, and they thought that it would be a good idea if we were able to get in and bring that oil out, because they're not doing what they should, and we can do that, and we'll sell a lot of oil. We're gonna be selling lots of oil. We are going to be selling lots of oil, Sandy. How long will it take to bring that apparatus, which has been ignored for decades now, in Venezuela, up to speed? And then once it's done, Sandy, who's going to be profiting?
Well, there you go. I mean, we're not talking about setting up a sovereign fund that's owned by the Venezuelan people and having them license the rights to the oil to the likes of Chevron and others. That would be something like the Norwegian model, which has benefited the people of Norway. But we're talking, I guess, about simply granting the rights of drilling with some kind of royalty being paid for those rights. And I don't know who the royalties get paid to, but presumably the coffers of Venezuela.
Business.
But and those coffers might get pilfered by the politicians who otherwise corruptly control it, or it might go to the for the benefit of the people, depending. But there was also, in that same discussion, the president talked about how we'll let the Venezuelans have some of the money.
Yes.
It was kind of a generous concept, I thought. My problem with what is happening now is that it makes the United States look a little bit like something that might have been in The Godfather, in that it's sort of like saying you've got a nice little country there. It'd be a shame if something bad happened to it. Let's be friends. Because that's the kind of talk of the sword rattling with Colombia and mentioning of the other countries as well. I fear that we need to be restrained about the way in which we decide that we're going to avail ourselves of the opportunities that are provided in these other countries. We have to make sure that the deal is good for both sides. And that's the art of, you know, the true art of the deal, maybe not the same one that was written about. The true art of the deal is to make a transaction which is beneficial, mutually beneficial, and therefore sustainable, because both sides will be happy with the agreement, and they won't decide they want to bring a lawsuit about the deal because it's turning out so badly for them. And, you know, in the international context, you don't bring lawsuits, but you have other kinds of antisocial behavior that develops.
Well, you know, Sandy, it might have been maybe, if all things being equal and our government running the way it should run, the Congress right now would step in and say, whoa, wait a minute, hold it. Okay, you can't do these things. You're moving too fast. We've got some say-so in this. But Sandy, Congress is missing in action.
Well, like I said, in one of our earlier podcasts, one of the issues is that some of the things that are done so quickly that even if Congress acts, it's already happened, right? It's a fait accompli. Now, the problem on this one for the administration is that it's not clear that this will be a fait accompli, that there probably will be required a great deal of follow-up action by the United States in some affirmative fashion. I hope it's not boots on the ground and actual warfare, but you know the current administration said we're not afraid of boots on the ground.
Yes,
We already had them on the ground, and we might well do it again. So you know, I there are those in Congress, in particular, and then some of them on both sides of the aisle, who want to assert the power of Congress. It's a difficult process because it's a little bit like the Supreme Court. The only ultimate power that Congress has to seize control over a president who has gone rogue about the power of the Congress is impeachment. And so absent impeachment, the president, so long as the army and the military continue to honor the orders of its commander-in-chief, Congress is left without any method for enforcing itself other than the impeachment of the president who they deem to have gone rogue with respect to the division of powers between Congress and the presidency. So, you know, this is a different kind of a constitutional crisis. It's not one that relates directly to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court would ultimately potentially rule on whether the presidential act is constitutional or not. But, you know, our country wasn't set up for the controls of the various pillars of our government to exercise anything but the process of norms. Meeting the norms means that the process continues and persists. When you start coloring way outside the lines of what have been the norms, it's very difficult for a government to self-regulate.
So, Sandy, all of this sounds to me like in the vernacular of chess, we've been checkmated, the American people, because we sit here and there appears to be nothing we can do to change the trajectory of where we're headed right now.
The American people have to decide whether what they think of the trajectory. I mean, I'm confident there are those of us who are excited about the prospects that are offered by the trajectory that is currently in place, and that is this notion of domination in the Western Hemisphere and the exercise of might to make right. You know, there are some who say, yeah, it's about time. You know, we've had too much patience with Cuba. We've we've had too much patience with the likes of Venezuela, and this is something that should have happened in the past. Now, I'm not sure that we speak for all of the people of the country when we voice concern about this. My concern about this is more long term. Okay, this happened, and we've done things like this in the past. We've exercised gunboat diplomacy, but my concern is, what does this mean, and what does it portend with respect to the long term? And if we continue to behave where we continue to say out loud, to speak out loud about what the quiet part, and we continue to flex our muscles in such an ostentatious way, what will that do to the rest of the world in terms of how they deal with us? Because ultimately, there is an alliance in the world that can deal with the kind of might and power that the United States has. It just might take a substantial international opinion running counter to us, but I'm not at all sure that couldn't happen. We're rapidly fraying the knots that bound us with, for instance, Western Europe.
Well, Sandy, I'll tell you, me personally, I am happy that this is being done in broad daylight. I have for decades been opposed to these things being done in the dark, because it just, when the American people aren't made aware of what is being done in our name all over the earth, I think that stinks. And so the fact that it at least is out there for the world to see, you stated rightfully so that there's, a segment of this nation that agrees with all of those things that are being done right now. I would venture to say that's not the majority of the American people. That's a segment of the American people that are living really well, who see it through that prism. But that doesn't change the dynamic for the everyday American, Sandy, who sees this as something that is not as important as our everyday survival as American citizens.
Well, like I said, the political process requires the American public to stand up, voice itself. We'll have midterms elections coming this year, actually. And so, we're going to have an opportunity to see what the American people think about the current direction of the country. And its foreign policy might be front and center with respect to that. Foreign policy used to be a matter of bipartisan consistency, and we didn't have much division between the parties with respect to how they viewed foreign policy. But the more we color outside the lines, the more we move away from the rules of order that have been in place in the past, the more likely it is that there might be those in the country who have differing views about it. There are those on the far right who are the Rand Paul, for instance, sort, who are just as worried about the exercise of the power of the presidency in international affairs outside the constraints of the Congress. There might be some political tests here as well. I just think that with the quiet part being said out loud so clearly now, I'll be very interested in the extent to which the American public, where we decide we come down on this, because exercising for foreign policy, which is basically justified by might makes right, should possibly make a fair number of Americans uncomfortable. But, there have been other regimes in other parts of the world where it created pride amongst the people and created an ebullience and an optimism that their might take them as far as they wanted to go.
So Sandy, Americans' foreign policy to Tom, Dick, and Mary right now the people in this nation, Tom, Dick, and Mary, are concerned about their everyday survival. They can't focus on America's foreign policy. That can't be put out front for the average American citizen who's worried about employment, who's worried about keeping a roof over their heads and paying for, especially a terrible winter where the paying for the gas and all of those kind of things is front and center. The foreign policy part of this, Sandy, is that's not even coming into many of the American people's purview right now.
Politics can make strange bedfellows, and that's an odd term to use when you hear who I'm going to describe. But Marjorie Taylor Greene is saying the very same thing. You know, that America First is all about the American people first. It's not about the Venezuelan people. It's not about the rest of the world.
Right.
It's about the it's about what the American people need and want. And, you know, the notion that opening up the oil reserves of Venezuela is going to make a lot of people rich. I mean, the people who get rich from oil are the people who own the oil wells. The oil industry is not a terribly big employer. In particular, if you're only in the extraction business and you're loading the oil on boats and shipping it away. So, you know, building up the oil industry will increase the tax revenue for a country like Venezuela. It could be indirectly beneficial to the people and would be indirectly beneficial to the people of Venezuela, but the people who are going to get rich from it are the people who own the wells and own the oil that comes out of it, which is, I think, in the vision of the current administration, many of those people will be large American oil companies. And so when we think about the welfare of the American people, it's not going to be because oil companies in this country get rich. It's going to be because the focus of attention begins to focus on the things that the American people need to get fixed. And one of those is they need to get incomes from their jobs that make things affordable to them. But from the healthcare standpoint, we really need to roll up our sleeves and fix the design of our healthcare system, how we fund it, and then we need to make sure that it's available to all of the American people. And that's not going to get fixed by a pure market mechanism.
So Sandy, I agree with you 100%. But, you know, at where we're now focused and where the media is focused, and there's no telling how long we're going to be focused on this. This is a big deal, Sandy. Let's not lead people to believe that what took place, and I know you're not doing that, that what took place is not a major earth-shattering issue that just took place. It certainly deserves to be top of line focus because of all the other things that can come along behind what happened. So we can't just totally dismiss that, you know, and start worrying about the things that, you know, really are the things that impact and affect the people that I see and that I'm in the community where I live who are struggling every day.
Well, interestingly, there are those cynics who believe that the administration has become particularly adventuresome about its foreign affairs and the potential for war because of the fact that it will deflect interest from things which are politically unappealing for it to otherwise have attention paid to currently. And, of course, that will only work if this adventure is not as successful as it was initially announced to be. I mean, it's been announced as an overnight adventure that the military is not going to necessarily be involved in the future. We're just going to exercise leverage over the leadership of Venezuela to get to change their policies. That kind of an outcome doesn't deflect attention for very long because the media only has an appetite for this for a limited period of time. It will deflect attention for a long time if it runs amok, if we end up in a quagmire that includes a great deal of involvement of Americans in Venezuela. And so that's something to be concerned about. And that, I suppose, is a political failure and a political success if it's all it's wanted is, if all that's desired is deflection.
But Sandy, only time will tell that.
But I think that what the American people needs to do is, number one, take a test of themselves to see how they feel about their country exercising imperial might. And number two, determine in their own mind what their own priority of interests are and whether their personal interests are best served by a nation which focuses more attention on fixing health care and less attention on international adventurism.
You know, Sandy, international adventurism is something even in the best of times the American people have not focused on. You know, one of the things that the American people, depending on your status, economic status in this country, that's not something that a lot of the people that I know have spent a lot of time worrying about. It's always been, you know, making sure you kept a roof over your head and food in the stomachs, and if there was possibly a way that you can save a couple nickels. But that's gotten even more difficult, Sandy, and you know, there is no magic bullet, there's no magic wand that's going to even fix that immediately. So that suffering for the American people, Tom, Dick, and Mary, is going to continue for some time, Sandy. It'll get worse before it gets better.
Yeah, I mean, I think that these kinds of events need to be wake-up calls for Tom, Dick, and Mary to evaluate their own priorities and evaluate their own sensibilities and to be reactive to national policies which are not centered on their own interests and the improvement of a lot of the American people. And so, we'll see, because there's going to be a fair amount of reverberation from something like what happened over the weekend.
And so last thing. So Sandy, if there's one thing I think that can be taken away from all of this, it's that the American people should really be focused on who their elected officials are and what they're doing. Because it's our only way of being able to, you know, make some things happen for us. We can't unilaterally do it ourselves. There's nothing we as American citizens individually, we can't petition our government and say those things. We've got people who we elect to do that. So we've got to make sure at least that the people that we have in those positions who represent us and speak for us, Sandy, we got to make sure that they're hearing us. Is that right?
Well, yes. And, you know, I think that there's been a fair amount of cynicism developed in Washington about the extent to which you can talk the American people into doing just about anything, that regardless of their personal interests, if you cloak it in a manner that gets them excited, and excited, maybe angry is another word that is equated with the kind of excitement they're talking about. So I think as people begin to sober up, become less angry with one another, and begin to evaluate what's going on, I think we might find that they'll step forward in politics and that they'll be pulling their lever in a manner that's more rationally based on their own interests. And I do have a sense that the anger we have with one another is dissipating, and that possibly we're putting ourselves in the position of more rational conduct.
Yeah, I mean, it absolutely is going to be necessary as we move forward. Well, thank you as always, my friend. You know, we can talk for another several hours on this, but it's still early. And you're the guy I thought about when I first got up and saw, and I couldn't wait to call you and hear your thoughts. But thank you very much as always, man. We'll talk again soon.
Yeah, talk to you soon.
All right, see you later, Sandy.